As we are approximately galloping forward 50 years per speaker, we are going to have Robert Royal speaking on the thought of Chesterton in his book, What I Saw in America. Robert Royal is the Vice President and Olin Fellow in Religion and Society at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. His degrees are a BA and MA from Brown, a PhD from Catholic University. His analysis or deconstruction of the deconstruction of Columbus. His most recently edited volume 21 of the collected works of G.K. Chesterton, which includes What I Saw in America, on which he will speak. Royal.
Me clairvoyant, me conscious of you, old camarado, needing no telescope, lorgnette, field glass, opera glass, myopic pince-nez, me piercing 2,000 years with eye naked and not ashamed. The crowd cannot hide you from me. Musty old feudal heraldic trappings cannot hide you from me. I perceive that you drink. I am drinking with you. I am as drunk as you are. I see that you are inhaling tobacco, puffing, smoking, spitting. I do not object to your spitting. You, prophetic of American largeness, you anticipating in the broad masculine manners of these states. I see in you also there are movements, tremors, tears, desires for the melodious. I salute your three violinists endlessly making vibrations, rigid, relentless, capable of going on forever. They play my accompaniment, but I shall take no notice of any accompaniment. I myself am a complete orchestra. So long. I start with this poem from G.K. Chesterton because, first of all, I think it's a wonderful poem, and it took me many readings to realize that what it is a recasting of Old King Cole in the style of Walt Whitman. In case you didn't notice that the first time through, there's your three violinists endlessly making vibrations, etc. If you want to read it again, it's worth it. But there's something about that Chestertonian vision of America, because it's an American projection on a medieval past, which, as in the first line, me clairvoyant, I think really does point to a certain type of clear seeing that Chesterton had about the United States. It's always a bit difficult to describe what it is that Chesterton does when he writes about the United States. He's certainly not a statesman like Lord Bryce, and he's not a political philosopher or even a philosopher, or, God forbid, a sociologist. Hugh Kenner once called Chesterton a metaphysical journalist, and Chesterton said in reply, "No, I am a jolly journalist." He sought fun in whatever he wrote about. But for anyone who appreciates Chesterton, there's a funny kind of way in which Chesterton is always writing about one subject, which is his view of what humanity ought to be, but there's a funny way in which his contact with America draws him into saying some unusual things. And I guess that's what I would like to talk with you about briefly this afternoon. Now, don't think that this drinking, by the way, is a secondary matter. It's not just a matter of good masculine fun the way it appears in the poem, because Chesterton arrived here for the first time. He came twice, once in 1921 and once in 1930 and 1931, which is to say during the period of Prohibition. And if you know anything at all about Chesterton, you can imagine the enormous hangdog look of thirst that enormous man must have had on his face as he went about America, except that he found, he said, that Americans He wasn't going to talk about prohibition when he was here. He thought it was none of his business. But then he said, I found that Americans themselves were quite willing to talk about it over the nuts and the wine. In fact, they were even willing to leave out the nuts to discuss it. He thought that prohibition was a very bad sign because, as he put it, prohibition was simply unconstitutional. That it was the beginning of a whole series of things with which we are now much more familiar, which really seek to interfere profoundly with the most private dimensions of our lives. As in everything else that Chesterton did, however, he saw a silver lining in this. And when I first read through his two books on America, the first is called What I Saw in America. That's that on the 1921 trip. The other is called Sidelights on the New London and the Newer York. It's a very little-known book, but there's some marvelous things in it if you like Chesterton. But there's a chapter in this latter book in which is called In Praise of Prohibition. And when you come upon that, knowing who Chesterton was and what his personal habits were like, it seems impossible. But what he says is that he's found that perhaps government should start prohibiting all sorts of different things. I wish that the result that he found in America back then would continue to be true. It seems to me that when the government prohibits now, it succeeds. But what he found was that at an American university, as he delicately puts it, and as I indelicately will reveal to you, was Notre Dame University, he said, where practically every one of the professors brews his own beer, some of them experimenting in two or three different kinds, he was very pleased with this development. And he said he looked forward to a university in which, should this prohibition continue, quote, the professor of the higher metaphysics will be proud of his strong ale. The professor of the lower mathematics, otherwise known as high finance, will allege something more subtle in his milder ale. The professor of moral theology, whose ale, I'm sure, is the strongest of all, will offer to drink all the other dons under the table without any ill effect on the health. And that, he thought, would be a good change in the situation of professors both in his own country and in ours. Now, a lot of this stuff is fun, and a lot of it, of course, goes to the heart of many of the problems that we've been talking about all day in 20th century America. Chesterton is not exactly on target about why it is that prohibition existed in the United States. Looking at his own English experience, he thought it was because rich men and industrialists in America wanted workers who would be more productive. In point of fact, I think from the historical studies that I've seen, this was a bad response to a real problem. But part of a moral reconstruction that actually brought crime down and caused some very good things to happen at the beginning of the century, even though it did trample on our constitutional liberties. But one of the things that I think Chesterton discerned in America at that time, and now we're talking in the 20s and 30s, that perhaps is another aspect that's disappeared in our national spirit, is precisely this. He said, Americans have a power that is the soul and success of democracy, the power of spontaneous organization. What he found sort of everywhere in America was that whatever governmental obstacles existed, there seemed to be a kind of a popular response that he praised, something spontaneous, something among the people that he didn't detect in his own country or in Europe in general. And I think that distinctive aspect of America still exists, but probably to a lesser degree than even 50 or 60 years ago. Now, I'd like to just break down Chesterton's theory, insofar as there is a theory in these rather rambling, unfocused books on America, into two points that I think more or less cover the waterfront of what he has to say about America. The first is about democratic theory. Perhaps the most widely quoted sentence of Chesterton about the United States is that America is a nation with the soul of a church. You often hear that cited by people who have never read anything else by Chesterton. I think that it's right to point to that, and it's certainly an important and central notion in his idea of what distinguishes America from other nations. He says, America has because Americans do not have a character, they have a creed. There are, in the Declaration of Independence, even references to God and spelled out tenets, spelled out articles of the creed. But that is only the rudiment. That's only the beginning, I think, of Chesterton for what America really is. Those tenets of the creed are an enabling factor. They aren't a defining factor the way they have been in so many other countries. He finds there are a lot of oddities in the United States that get explained by the idea of the fact that all Americans have to at least subscribe to this minimal creed. When he was applying for his visa, for example, in a very funny passage, he has to fill in a customs form, and one of the questions that is asked is, do you plan the violent overthrow of the government of the United States? And he says, I can just imagine some wild Bolshevik seeing this and writing down, well, yes, of course I'm planning this. You know, why would the Americans ask a question like this? But he said, then I began to think a bit further, he said, where there is no type, Englishmen know that if you invite Uncle Harold out to the country house and he's a radical, he's not about to blow up the house or steal the children or hold hostages, that there is a national type and there is a kind of an ethos in England that does not exist in America. That, he says, if you are going to invite the Hairy Ainu or someone from Samsatska into your house, you're going to want to ask yourself exactly how hairy is this Ainu? Or what religion does this person from Samsatska practice? So when the question is asked, do you plan do you advocate the violent overthrow of the government? Chesterton says it's not an entirely idle question. And one he said, which he would be happy to answer after he had seen the United States. The final point about this, this democratic theory is that he says America is a melting pot, and there certainly was a tremendous amount of immigration at the time, but that, and I'm quoting here, the melting pot itself must not melt. The original shape was traced in the lines of Jeffersonian democracy, and it will remain in that shape until it becomes shapeless. I think a very important point about immigration. Now, it is sometimes assumed that Chesterton doesn't think that there is an American type, because, as I said, he said Americans have a creed because they do not have a character. They have a test asking you certain things before you can be admitted, because there is not a type of an American. But my second large point about his views of America is that, in fact, there are many different characteristic American types. And I'll just very briefly try to give you some examples of those. Chesterton was really quite struck by what he detected to be an almost timeless poetry about America, that there had been something transferred to these shores that suggested an almost eternal way of life. He was particularly appreciative of the cities like Boston and Philadelphia and Baltimore and also Washington, because they had that rather genteel quality. And he said about them, there are old brown houses in the corners of squares and streets that are like glimpses of a man's forgotten childhood. And when I saw the long paths with posts where the autocrat may be supposed to have walked with the schoolmistress, I felt I had come to the land where the old tales come true. It's a beautiful image of what some of America used to be like then, and I think much less is today. He was much less taken with New York, as one might imagine. He made there the famous remark that most of you are probably familiar with. Chesterton had this wonderful childlike ability to walk into a situation and just see something without any intervening conceptual filters. And he saw Times Square, and he looked at all those lights at night, and he said, oh, what a glorious garden of delights this would be for a man unable to read. When he got here to Chicago, he was very impressed. He was very impressed with Michigan Avenue, which he said was a grand avenue being built by a great city along a great lake. And he saw a number of other particular things that are of interest. He debated here at the Chicago Ethical Society is psychology a curse? He debated with a real pill of a psychologist who it looks like he was able to vanquish in the debate. But another thing happened while he was here in Chicago. This is in the 20s and 30s, and just let me tell you about this briefly. He says, while I was in Chicago, he was very impressed, by the way, with the way the mafia kept the violence within its own borders, how the criminals actually had a code of chivalry and honor, and it was a wonderful thing. He said, while I was in Chicago, a very distinguished individual had the misfortune to be murdered, being caught between the fire of two machine guns and falling with a ton of lead in him. But as I gather that the same gentleman had himself murdered no less than 34 persons in exactly the same way, it was impossible to feel that any advantage had been taken of his innocence and youth, or that he had been led into a game of which the rules had not been explained to him. This might be of some use in our current attempts to deal with crime and our seemingly inability to think that people who commit crimes actually know what they're getting themselves into. That is the cities. That's basically what he thought about the cities. The Midwest in general was very fascinating for Chesterton, and I think it's here that he found a particular type. He was also fascinated by the South because he thought that the South somehow had a genteel tradition that was probably richer than the industrial North. He did not like industry. He was a type of agrarian, a type of fugitive himself, what he called a distributist. He was not at all sure that it was a good thing that the South had lost the war between the states. He wasn't sure it was a good thing that slavery had been abolished. But he thought that probably something had narrowed and something had gone out of the American tradition because of the defeat of the South. And so he was rather complex in his reaction to that. But about the Midwest, he thought that there was an unusual quality to it in his day. I don't know how familiar he was with more agricultural areas, but this is where I think his poetic eye gives us an insight into something that we may want to pay some attention to. He thought he discerned an ideal in the Midwest that no longer existed in the East. He said that in these small self-governed areas, after all, the people do achieve what many prophets and righteous men have died to achieve. The plain village, fairly prosperous, fairly equal, untaxed by tyrants and untroubled by wars, is after all the place which reformers have regarded as their aim whenever reformers have had their wits sufficiently to have any aim. And that there was some strange way in which the Midwest had embodied a final, finally this small town American democracy that had almost disappeared from everywhere else. The problem as he saw it, and Chesterton spoke as a Roman Catholic, was that there were two spiritual factors in the Midwest that bothered him. One was a kind of a Puritanism that made Main Street narrower than he thought it ought to be. It wasn't a gay, in the old sense of the term, country life the way, say, French peasantry had been. He thought that the culture had come from the cities and was largely Calvinistic and therefore was a little sour. But he also thought that agriculture in America had become mechanized, and that therefore the almost religious appreciation for the land had in some way evaporated from our people. Although there was still a lot of veneration, it wasn't quite what he thought had been there earlier. Now, there are many other things I could say, but just by way of conclusion, I think the most miraculous essay that Chesterton ever wrote on America comes in that book, Sidelights on New London and the New York. It's a little essay about Lincoln, actually about a statue of Lincoln that was being erected in London at the time. I invoke Lincoln with great perspicacity in this audience, never knowing who's going to say what about that figure. But I think Chesterton saw something remarkable in Lincoln that is clairvoyant, to go back to my opening point, about America as well. He says this, whilst I was in America, I often lingered in small towns and wayside places. And in a curious and almost creepy fashion, the great presence of Abraham Lincoln continually grew upon me. I think it necessary to linger a little in America, and especially in what many would call the most uninteresting or unpleasing parts of America, before this strong sense of a strange kind of greatness can grow upon the soul. As I said, there was a statue going to be put up in London, and there was a great controversy over the ugliness of the statue. And Chesterton continues, "I will not affirm that the sculptor conveyed the secret of which I speak, for I am by no means certain that it could be conveyed. Curiously enough, I feel as if it could be conveyed better by landscape than by sculpture. It is the landscape of America that conveys it most vividly to me, especially all the landscapes that would probably be most carefully avoided by a landscape painter." He's talking about a certain type of scene that I think we've all seen in the Midwest. And he concludes this way. "It was out of this landscape that the great president came, and one might almost trace a fanciful shadow of his figure in the thin trees and the stiff wooden pillars. A man of any imagination might look down these strange streets with their frame houses filled with the latest conveniences and surrounded with the latest litter, till he could see approaching down the long perspective that long, ungainly figure with preposterous stovepipe hat and rustic umbrella and deep, melancholy eyes, the humor and the hard posture and the heart that fed upon hope deferred." Beautiful image. But I want to just read a little bit more. It's worth reading this at length. "Nowhere else in the world could a man of exactly that type have been a great man. He would at best have been a good one, generally derided as an exceedingly dowdy sort of dunce or failure. It is the real glory of that great democracy, America, that it did draw out the capacities of such a man and turn him into a democratic leader. A demagogue who is not a dandy, or a sham gentleman, or for that matter, a real gentleman. Not a cynic, or one condescending to the common people, but one all the more great for a streak of something that was common." I think we all know we've lost whatever that mystery is that was in Lincoln, but Chesterton often reminds us that what human beings can lose, they can also regain, that we are not machines and the clock is not past a certain time forever. And it is my hope, and I'm sure it is yours too, that someday we can recover that profound spirit that Chesterton identified in America. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Roy.